Welcome back, everyone. This is Kelly Mason and Leslie Carson. Happy New Year. We hope that you enjoyed some rest and relaxation. It's my favorite time of the year because I feel like everything just sort of shuts down that week after Christmas and I have to really think about what day it is. So I love that feeling. So New Year celebration, we've had over 3,000 downloads on our podcast. Yay. So thank you to all of our listeners. Okay, Leslie, tell us about today's podcast.
Yes, episode 11 titled The Developmental Pediatrician is with our guest, Dr. Catherine Burns, developmental pediatrician in the Kansas City area. But before we bring Dr. Burns on, hey, Kelly, tell me something good.
Tell me something good.
Yes, thank you to Katie Holting for sending this to me. This story comes out of Northern Kentucky. Mike and Savannah Wise have been caring for their daughter, Oakley, who has severe medical problems. She was born at 29 weeks, her dad, Mike, said, and then she spent about 4 months in the NICU. She had her first heart procedure where they go in, they put mesh in, and she also had a brain bleed when she was born. She's actually a lot better than she used to be, so that's a blessing. Oakley, 3, suffers from pulmonary vein stenosis, a rare disease that narrows the veins connecting the heart and the lungs. The family lived in Boston for 2 months so Oakley could get specialized care, and she's still hooked up to oxygen tape. The Make-A-Wish Foundation is sponsoring a family trip to Disney World for Oakley and Mike Wise and Samantha Wise, and they came up with the idea to make it a honeymoon. Oakley loves Elmo and the Little Mermaid. The Wises shared their moment with Oakley and with the family and friends who supported them. They've already been together for 8 years, and this wedding is more of a recommitment. This girl lights up a room, Oakley's dad said. There's not a room she goes into that when she smiles, everybody doesn't smile. She has made so many leaps and bounds now. The doctors and everybody are amazed. So when I tell everybody that this is a true miracle sitting here, I mean that it is a miracle that she is here.
It's a great story. I'm so happy that they get to celebrate all of it, their honeymoon and all of it together in Disney World. Yeah. Well, let me introduce our guest today, Dr. Burns. Dr. Burns graduated from the University of Arkansas for medical sciences and then stayed in Arkansas for her pediatric residency and developmental behavior fellowship. She then worked at Arkansas Children's Hospital and the University of Arkansas for medical sciences for 2 years. Before moving with her husband to San Antonio, Texas for 2 years, followed by 5 years in Jonesboro, Arkansas. They moved to Overland Park, Kansas 5 years ago, and she's worked at Overland Park Regional Medical Center Special Care Clinic for about 2.5 years before setting out on her own. And she now works 1+ days a week at the Leanne Britton Development Center. So welcome, Dr. Burns. Thank you so much for joining us.
I hear a lot of Arkansas in that intro. Is that where you're originally from?
Yes, I grew up in central Arkansas. And so until we moved to Texas, I did not move around a whole lot. I mean, within 30 miles.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I like Arkansas. It's really nice.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I do have a question about the picture in your background. Nobody else can see it but us, but there are these two adorable kitties. I also have a kitty calendar up on my wall, but I was just wondering, you know, is this your office?
No, this is my daughter's bedroom, but it was the quietest room in the house today because we have a little bit of not really construction, but like maintenance stuff going on.
No, I love it. It reminds me of like the 80s where, you know, there's the cats and it's like, hang in there. Anyways, I love it.
Yes.
So tell us about what made you want to become a doctor, specifically a developmental pediatrician.
I knew from high school I wanted to go to medical school and like literally made every choice from I went to the state math and science school when I was 15 because I wanted more science opportunities than my local public school could offer. And then also chose my college based on where am I not going to have loans because I'm going to go to medical school. I will have loans. And then when I was in medical school and you just rotate through different rotations, I enjoyed pediatrics, but had no idea that developmental pediatrics was a thing. At that time, it just wasn't a rotation for medical students. And so it never crossed my mind until my second year when I did my developmental pediatric rotation and thought, wow, this is really fun. I had always enjoyed the medically complex patients. And so developmental pediatrics fits in with caring for those children very well. And then it just happened that Arkansas was restarting its fellowship program. And so I could just slide right on into the fellowship after my pediatric residency.
That's nice. Great. Can you explain the difference between a general pediatrician and a developmental pediatrician? I didn't even know it was a thing until I found out.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So general pediatrics is the residency program. It's a 3-year program. The overall rotations are pretty uniform across the United States. There's some variation. You get to choose a few months, like maybe 6 months of the 3 years that you get to have an opinion about what you do. But a lot of the experience is pretty standardized with time rotating through the ER, ICUs, cardiology, the NICUs, all those things. And then after you complete your general pediatric residency, you then do another 3-year fellowship in developmental behavioral pediatrics. And so, frankly, fellowship's a lot more fun than residency because you're getting to do what you like and to study what you enjoy. And in developmental pediatrics, because it is such a broad specialty where pretty much anything that can impact a child's behavior development is fair game and is covered, you can really tailor your fellowship a little bit. So there's people who really focus on ADHD and focus on medication management. I liked children who are medically complex, so I did more NICU follow-up and care coordination clinics and things like that. All developmental pediatricians do spend a significant portion of their fellowship with autism and developmental assessments.
Okay, so it sounds like from the developmental peds, you have that extra 3 years, and it sounds like to continue to work and learn and practice more of that behavioral assessment, diagnosis, that kind of thing.
Yes, and you also get to interact more with other specialties like therapists, physical, occupational, speech, language, as well as psychology in a variety of different forms. And so we also, as part of the autism evals, we sit through the psychology portion. We sit through the speech therapist portion. And although I would never consider myself qualified to administer some of those tests, I'm familiar with the components. And when parents can describe it to me, even, I generally have an idea what kinds of assessments were performed.
Okay. And if you're a general pediatrician, they're not having that extra training and all of that.
Right. Many of them are very comfortable with ADHD management with the basic medications, but have not necessarily had experience with also child psychiatry and extra neurology and stuff with some of the less first line treatments, I would say.
Thank you for sharing that. Well, when might a family need a referral to a developmental pediatrician? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
The most common time will be for autism assessment, although developmental pediatricians work in a variety of other clinics, such as very common NICU follow-up or complex care clinics. That will probably be the main time. The other time will be if your child already has a diagnosis of autism or specific genetic disorder, and you are concerned about other symptoms like ADHD, anxiety, mood dysregulation, sleep, when developmental pediatricians can either make recommendations about further evaluations or help with medication management.
So are developmental pediatricians typically someone the family sees once, or do they monitor the child's care?
Both. It really depends on the need. Again, if it's for mostly autism diagnostics, it can be one or two visits. However, if more care coordination or medication management, then that can be ongoing from literally birth until 18 to 21, kind of depends on the exact program.
Who usually initiates the referral to a developmental pediatrician?
So that's a little variable based on where you are. Where I trained in Arkansas, the pediatricians, primary care providers, generally initiated. Here in the Kansas City metro, especially with the main children's hospital here, their autism assessment is parent-driven. And so usually how it functions in this community is the pediatrician will tell the parent, give them a list of resources, and then the parent reaches out. But that is not necessarily standard across all communities in the United States.
How do you work with early intervention programs like here in Kansas? And what role do they play?
So in my roles right now, I do not make as many referrals to early intervention because many of my patients are already enrolled. When I was doing more NICU follow-up, I did a lot more referrals to early intervention services. And now it's more talking to the parents about, okay, What are you working on at home with your early intervention provider? What are your goals? Is there anything else we need to consider or add on? Anyone else you need to ask them about bringing onto the team for that? And then I also work with our local county early intervention program to help try to expedite the autism diagnostic process because the wait lists here are excessively long.
Are the wait lists at right now? Do you know?
It's a little bit variable based on age, but it's usually still about 9 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pretty long.
That's very long. Yeah.
And this long. What is the reasoning behind that, do you think?
Well, part of it is just autism evaluations take a long time and the documentation takes even longer. And so you can literally, I mean, two in a day is a very busy day. That's, I mean, it's simply a intake time limitation to some degree. You can only complete what you can complete, and there are time limitations, and you can't go through and evaluate 10 kids with autism in a day. So,
why is early intervention so important for children's development?
So there is lots of evidence that it doesn't even matter what the cause of developmental delay is. Early intervention overall improves outcomes. And so I always give the example of people with Down syndrome. It was not uncommon in the 70s that many of them actually never walked. And now that is incredibly rare because we know, okay, they do need the extra physical therapy and there's interventions to help them get stronger. We know how to help them achieve better by supporting them early in their development. We can provide the early intervention support for their speech, for their feeding, all these other things that can really improve their outcome. So early intervention is at that time when a child's brain has the most plasticity and can learn new skills or basically rewire the easiest. And your brain still has plasticity older, but those first 5 years are absolutely the most critical for forming those pathways that are going to last for a lifetime.
Thank you. Thinking about your interactions with parents, you talked about that. What questions do you hear most often from parents?
So a lot of times it's really, what do I do next? Or am I doing enough? And so many parents just want to make sure that they're exploring all options for their child. And it literally can be everything from therapy to diets to supplements, all those things. And I would say that's like the most basic level that most parents are questioning.
And when you say diet, like, what do you mean by that?
If there's anything they need to take out, food dyes. In the past, it was gluten-free, casein-free when I started in training was a really big one, and things like that. So, you know, there are still some questions about that. Or my child doesn't eat a very good variety of food. Do I need a vitamin or supplement?
So, Okay. And what is it, like, what does the research say about food dyes? Do you feel comfortable talking about that?
Yeah. So the research is really kind of mixed. If you look at an overall population, ADHD is going to be the population with the biggest studies. It's not particularly helpful. However, if you look more specifically at individuals, I have way too many kids whose parents are like, oh, it just goes bad, especially with the red food dyes. Some of the dyes that we have in the United States are not allowed in Europe for very specific reasons. And so food dyes are one of those things that when parents ask me, I'm like, none of us need that in our diet. Like, that is not a necessary nutrient. It can be challenging, but you aren't going to like suffer from lack of red food dye. Yeah. So while it can be a challenge, it's also one of those things you're like, it's only there for aesthetic reasons. It doesn't serve a nutritional purpose.
Yeah. Well, I will say as a parent, I can see when my child has red food dye or sugar, the difference in behavior.
100%. And so, I mean, I usually tell parents, I feel like there's probably a subset that we just don't know how to identify. And for some people, it doesn't make any difference. But if it makes a difference for your child, pay attention to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a great point. So our next question is from another early interventionist.
Hi, Dr. Burns. Thanks for coming on the podcast and taking time to share your knowledge and your experience with us. I think my question for you today is based on your years of experience. And that question is, what are some of the trends that you have seen over your years of practicing, I always felt like there was a burst of something. So for example, I've been practicing 30 years. I would say it's been about 20 years ago. All these children that were receiving a diagnosis of deaf or hard of hearing, or then autism came into play. I don't even know what the prevalence is now, 1 in 31. And that's been a question for the last few years. You know, are people being overdiagnosed, or is it simply that we're more educated, or I don't know, your thoughts on that, some of those sort of things. Then, I don't know, an increase in sleep disturbances, much more prevalent now. What do you attribute to these clusters over the years of diagnoses?
Well, we'll start with the sleep one because I feel like the answer is the most obvious. And we know sleep hygiene is very important and sleep routine. And then there is no question that blue lights from screens impact sleep, like no question whatsoever. And you can find study after study of, it doesn't even matter the age, from babies to school-age children to teenagers to adults, that excessive exposure, especially in those few hours before bed, can impact sleep quality. So although I'm sure there's more going into that, the prevalence of screens all over our lives, especially with these very, very bright blue light screens, is impacts your brain's melatonin production and definitely impacts sleep. So I feel like that one's a pretty easy answer. And while I'm sure screens aren't 100% of it, it's a substantial portion.
I have a question really quick about that. What does the research say, like, regarding sleep hygiene? When, like, prior to sleep, should we eliminate the screens to help?
Minimal an hour, but really 2 hours is going to be optimal.
Okay.
And is there any other, I'm going to say, sleep hygiene things, steps, actions that would be helpful for sleep?
So keeping bedtime fairly stable is very important. And when I tell parents this, I'm like, you have a bedtime, you really try to hit it within 30 minutes before or after. Like, that is, you have a window. Overall, a routine. So something that doesn't involve screens, that is calming. It can be reading, listening to something, a bath for a child, anything like that. But having somewhat of a, not necessarily strict, rigid routine, but a pattern, a rhythm to your night that starts to tell the child, it's about bedtime. This is what we're getting ready to do. We're going to calm down now. And those are the most important. And then not having a screen on in the room, and generally cooler with darker, is going to be better as well.
Thank you for sharing that.
Now, as far as, you want me to go over the autism question?
Yes.
Okay. So I would say there's definitely trends. So for a while it was colic, and then it was everyone had reflux, and it just comes and goes. And tongue ties, I think, are like probably the longest historical one of, like, we definitely go through cycles of everyone has a tongue tie, no one has a tongue tie. And the truth is, there's probably a happy medium in there somewhere in that world. The autism question could be an entire podcast series of its own. Most of the studies and most researchers would agree a substantial proportion of the increase over the past 50 years has to do with changing diagnostic standards. Autism wasn't even in the DSM, which is how we come up with diagnostic criteria, until 1980. And then there have been changes in the criteria that have basically broadened what we can do and what we patients qualify substantially. And then a significant portion of the rise is also people and groups of people who we know have been underdiagnosed. So adults who had milder symptoms when they were younger and probably, you know, 30 years ago didn't qualify for a diagnosis. Minorities who historically have been underdiagnosed and we have not recognized their disabilities as early as we should. And then girls and women who can present differently, as well as mask pretty high in some situations. Now, that then leaves, there probably is a slight increase, but not as dramatic as you can sometimes see in the media. The challenge is, though, when you have studies that have looked at, okay, definitely we can attribute X percentage to diagnostic changes. They're all old. Like, I think the most recent one was 2005. And so the research into the we call that diagnostic substitution, is lacking over the past 20 years.
Can you explain what autism spectrum disorder is and what it looks like in children?
So autism spectrum disorder is a disorder of social communication skills, as well as atypical features, including repetition of words or movements, sensory integration differences, challenges with transitions and or rigidity, and intense interest. In children, it could present in many, many ways. We do not consider language disorder a core feature. And so when you're considering a child with autism, you do have to consider with or without language disorder. And that's part of the diagnostic criteria. And so when you're talking about social communication, it is integration of nonverbal skills, and not just eye contact, but gestures, body language, facial expressions into the child's communication, play skills, because play is communication based, and interactions and social reciprocity. And so in a baby that can look, or a very young toddler, that looks like, do they engage in peekaboo? Because that is a social game for a baby. When you're talking about a child that's four, by that age, we're starting to expect more interactive play with peers, where it's like, we're going to play, you know, pirates. I'll be the good guy. You're the bad guy. And we're starting to respond. But you can't always assess for those until a specific age, because development is a moving target. And so in many children, how it presents is with frustration related to communication. And that is frequently what parents will notice, or that they seem like they're in their own world. And frequently it does result in conflict, especially with peers, because they aren't picking up on the verbal and nonverbal communication. And so they have challenges and are not successful in those peer interactions. And that's the most common. One thing that's different in girls is that you don't always get motor stereotypies. So that's the hand flapping and toe walking as much. And you may not have as many obvious sensory challenges. So they may not be covering their ears as much with loud noises. Instead of becoming more dysregulated when they're overwhelmed, they may become more withdrawn. And so as with pretty much everything with those kind of internalizing, sometimes children with those kinds of issues are picked up later and presented later because people simply aren't recognizing their stress.
How do you diagnose ASD? Talk to us about that process.
So usually you're looking at a variety of skills, and you're looking to make sure that those skills we talked about previously are discrepant from their other skill levels. And so usually that's a combination of parent interview, a play-based assessment called the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Scale, as well as some sort of assessment of their sensory integration issues and their overall developmental skills.
So I love how you said combination. So like, I have a lot of parents that'll just say like, Johnny's walking on his toes. Does he have autism? I don't know. Is that something that you hear a lot? Just kind of like one thing picked out of, you know, a group of things.
Absolutely. Then, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And interestingly, like especially hand flapping can be fairly developmentally typical in that like 9 month range when they haven't quite figured out the full, when they're just excited.
Yeah.
And so you can definitely have a single feature and not meet criteria for autism spectrum disorder.
Yeah, I think it's hard because the hand flapping, even if the child's older and maybe there are no other signs of autism, it just looks a little different. And so I just talk with parents about it just looks a little different, you know, but these
exactly.
are
if it's yes, if it's and if it's not functionally impairing, right. Ultimately, all these have to also be functionally impairing. And so, yeah, if it's hand flapping alone, good for them. Right. That's how they say they're excited.
Absolutely.
Well, what does current research say about the causes of autism spectrum disorder?
This is another area where there's lots of ongoing changes. So we know probably 60% is related to something genetic. The challenge with this is that most single gene associations with autism, they don't guarantee a child or person's going to have autism. They increase the risk. So if you have a genetic difference in a family, in one person, it may look like ADHD or a learning disability or language disorder. And in another person, it may present as autism. We are still in a period of rapid advancement with genetics because Human Genome Project was not completed that long ago. And so we are just really learning what all these genes do. And then there are genes that also have multiple presentations of differences in them, which just makes it incredibly challenging. There are also environmental causes, as well as we do know that pretty much anything that can make your brain work differently increases your risk for autism. So babies who are born extremely prematurely increases the risk. Children who had hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, that also increases the risk.
That sounds really hard to say. I'm not even going to try to repeat you.
We usually say HIE because
And when you talk about like environmental factors, what would some of those be?
There are some links to pollution. And then there's things that, especially during pregnancy, women aren't in control of. And so I'm always hesitant to discuss it because I don't think moms need any more guilt. Mm-hmm. But there are things like some of the infections in pregnancy. Interestingly, Tylenol, not one of them. That is wrong.
Thank you.
But there are some exposures and some environmental, like overall, the risk is higher in areas with higher pollution, air pollution, and things like that. But those are things also that people can't necessarily control. They are literally in their environment. They don't have control over that aspect of their environment.
When you talked about the evaluations and one cause potentially being genetic, is that one recommendation that families receive if they're going through the evaluation process? Are they, encouraged to have genetic testing?
So it is offered to all families. One of the questions that does come up a lot from families is, what difference does that make? And sometimes, especially if the child's also having something like seizures, it can make a pretty big difference therapeutically because our knowledge of genes, seizures, and medications is rapidly evolving. It's offered. The recommendations are it's offered. Genetic testing is offered to all families, but it is up to them.
Okay. So my next question is, if a child shows one neurodivergent trait like inattention, hyperactivity, executive functioning challenges, sensory sensitivities, a learning disorder, anxiety, sleep issues, or social communication differences, why does that increase the likelihood of seeing other traits as well?
Well, I often tell parents, like when we say autism, ADHD, anxiety, we give those lines. Those are human-created lines. They are not lines in the brain. And so there's an awful lot of overlap in those kinds of symptoms that we, when we give it a name, have, I wouldn't say arbitrarily created, like they are created based on some on research, based on specific patterns. But our brain does not operate in isolated silos. Like we don't just, it's not a grocery store with little bitty cans on a shelf separated. All those neurons interact. And so anytime you have one, it's going to increase the other. And then they can impact each other. So if you're anxious, you may not go to sleep well. If you have a lot of sensory issues, you may not feel comfortable going to sleep. And so, yeah, the brain's just very interconnected.
Well, kind of shifting gears a little bit, how do you respond to, or what are your thoughts on the neurodiversity affirming movement?
So generally, it's good, and we should accept people with their differences. However, it very much runs the risk of alienating families whose loved ones have more significant challenges. And while there are people with autism who can be incredibly successful in life, insisting everyone does that it's not a disability is ignoring the experience of the family whose loved one is hitting their head to the point where they feel like they are endangering themselves. And so I think it's a balancing act, and it's up to each family. But I do find it interesting that when you do have older children with greater needs, frequently the families are like, don't water it down, like any assessment. Like, we want all the support we can get. We need it.
Mm-hmm.
And are a lot more open and frank about this is impairing for my loved one. And I also, like, it's great that some people in the autism community like to refer to themselves as autistics, not people with autism. But I am a parent of a child with Down syndrome. And in that community, they had to fight really, really hard for decades to use people first language. And so I'm glad some people like that, but I think that community also needs to be understanding that over time, how a person may identify or what their most functionally impairing feature or which community they may identify with may change. And so it's very important to always remember and treat the person as an individual beyond anything else. Because yeah, I've had people on my personal website get very upset that I didn't use, that I used people with autism, not autistics. And I'm like, no, you can use that language. But in my community, in my experience, in my belief system, I feel like using the people first language is most appropriate. And then the family can choose. And that is their choice. But I also don't feel like I'm the one who gets to tell them which community they wish to identify with. And, you know, a child may have a genetic disorder and autism. I don't know which community they're going to find like best for their family and find the most support in. So
I really like that insight of yours, because I feel like, I mean, when I went to college, it was always people first language. And so with this movement now, I feel like I struggle. I'm like, oh, what do I say? Which, you know what I mean? Am I saying it right? So I really like how you presented that just now.
Yeah.
They want to be, after I, you know, them, if they wish to be, you know, use that language, that's fine. But I feel like it's more respectful on my behalf to use the people first language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the NIH says basically you can use either one, like either one's acceptable.
So many families, I know, worry about the implications of an evaluation. You know, they talk, families are worried about labels or stigma. What advice do you have for parents considering these?
So I actually run into this quite a bit. And especially with teenagers and old, when a teenager will call, almost always ask the family, is the child aware? And are they okay with this? Because the question is, what are you going to get out of the diagnosis? If you're going to get extra services, that's very important. If you're going to get community with support, that is very important. Autism is one of the categories for special education. So sometimes that really can open up services. But it's, yeah, they have to consider, what are you going to get? The other interesting thing is that with commercial insurance especially, autism is one of the diagnoses that if they're going to increase the number of therapy sessions allowed, it's going to do it. Like that's going to be one of the magic terms. And as far as labels or stigma, it's is what you make it. I usually just try to tell the child, we're just describing how your brain works. That's not good or bad. It's just, this is how your brain works.
I always share with parents, it's more information about your child. You know,
yeah.
What you guys choose to do with it is your choice, but you're getting more information about your kiddo.
Yep.
Yeah. I think what you shared, Dr. Burns, probably plays into our next question. What are some reasons a family might pursue an evaluation or possible diagnosis? And you mentioned, you know, what are they getting out of the evaluation? Is it an opportunity, you know, to have an increasing community support or resources at school, things like that? What are some reasons, I guess, if a family is really, you know, challenged with having an evaluation, what are some other conversations that you have with parents?
That is usually more of a, okay, what are you afraid of? And what other services do you need? So for instance, you, as far as I know, cannot get applied behavioral analysis covered without an autism diagnosis. And so if your child needs that much support and that type of support, you're going to have to do it. I mean, it's just how insurance works. I've not met anyone who wanted to pay for ABA out of pocket. It's not an inexpensive service. And sometimes they just want to say, I want you to get to know them a few times, or, hey, I think they also have a lot of ADHD. Can we treat that first and see, okay, do social skills improve? Which is almost always like perfectly appropriate. But it is talking it through, okay, here are some, you know, pros and cons. Here are some benefits. It is a recognized disability. So there are some educational programming benefits. There are some support programs available and such.
I heard you mention ABA. Could you talk to us, like some people may not know what that is, and just kind of explain what it is and what are the recommendations for kind of the birth to three population on that?
So ABA is Applied Behavioral Analysis. It is a specific behavior intervention that is pretty structured. And it's also one that can be very intensive. So there are many places, especially center-based, that will do 30 to 40 hours a week. You can find lower, we call it lower volume places.
Ooh, I like that.
Yes, lower volume.
And it's official.
Yes. And ABA has the most evidence for individuals with autism for daily living skills and for non-desired behaviors, improving those. And it also has most evidence in the younger population, where on an almost, I have a few older kids in ABA programs, but most are going to be in that under school age. And many of the centers, especially here, do specialize in that younger age group. There are some centers which will allow basically half day. And so the child can attend here. Many of our pre-Ks are half day for the special education programs. So they can go half a day to the public school and then half a day to the ABA center. Most of the time when ABA is starting, they are providing services one-on-one to that child. So that child is getting a lot of attention. And that's one reason it's very expensive. And one reason why there's generally a long wait list as well, because it does require quite a bit of training in manpower. And there's just not quite the flexibility in their schedule to just bring in another child for 30 to 40 hours a week with one-on-one attention. And there are families. I feel like it's very important to also, tell families there are people who are adults with autism who did not have good ABA experiences when they were younger. I tell families, it's like anywhere else, like a daycare you'd send your kid, you have to go and you have to feel good about it. Mm-hmm. And you don't send your kid anywhere, you get the heebie-jeebies. Like, No, you don't do that. Like, you get to have an opinion and you have, I don't usually use the word duty as a parent, but just like choosing a daycare, like you go and you check it out. And ultimately, there are some children who I'm like, yes, they would definitely benefit from AB, but there are others who don't need that kind of support. And talking them through, okay, what do those options look like? And there are people who very much benefit from ABA and the kids go and are happy and like making a ton of progress. And you're like, that was clearly very, very good for them. I think it's also important for families to know that, the providers now will say the experiences of people 50 years ago, like nothing we did with people with differences and disabilities was great 50 years ago. We have a very different approach and we need to be open to that.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yes.
We have one more question. And I know our time is almost out, but kind of back to that evaluation piece. If an early interventionist goes with the family to an autism evaluation, what would be their role?
Frequently when they come, they will just frankly say, I'm here to be ears so that we can talk about it later. Uh-huh. Because frequently, especially in very young kids, the families are pretty overwhelmed. That it's the same child they walked in with, but that is still big news for them. Mm. So frequently the early intervention provider is the one who will process with the family and then talk through the recommendations and talk through here are the options and provide that emotional support for the family. And most of the time, that's literally what when they come to my evaluations, the EAE provider's like, I'm here to be ears. Like, that's my job.
Great. Okay. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. We always want to leave our listeners with one kind of tip or strategy. What would be one thing you would want every parent to know about child development?
One, that consistency and stability are important. And two, that anything you're trying to do, it's okay to start low and go slow. And that's everything from like stretches for torticollis. You just start with like every diaper change a few times to reading. You don't have to get your child to sit there and read through an entire book. You can start with just a few pages. That's okay.
That's a great tip.
Are there any resources or books or programs you recommend for families that are navigating developmental concerns? I know there's a lot of information out there.
So especially in the young population, your early intervention and providers are going to be the best resource for your local resources. If you have a child diagnosed with autism, I happen to like Autism Speaks. They generally will have fairly neutral and fact-based analysis of various treatment options and have a good amount of resources. And they have something called the first 100 days for both, I think it's actually young children and like teenagers for a diagnosis of autism. And then I happen to, bridge the line of Kansas and Missouri, both of those states have resource guides for families for autism that goes through basic overview. It's not a lot of detail. Basic overview of earlier intervention, so birth to three, 3 to 5, IEP, some basic educational rights. And those are all great places to start.
Thank you so much, Dr. Burns, for sharing your information. And we just enjoyed it. So thank you. As part of our podcast, we want to highlight someone or something as it relates to early intervention by giving them a shout out. And today, our shout out goes to intake coordinators for early intervention programs. Intake coordinators are the first interaction families have with early intervention services. They have a short period of time to build rapport, meet families where they are, and gather information so providers and teams feel confident in being able to support the child and family. That wraps up the episode, our episode, I should say, of the Early Intervention Podcast. Again, Dr. Burns, thank you again for joining us. And join us in February as we celebrate our year milestone. Woo-hoo! And continue to have conversations relevant to early intervention. You can listen to our podcast on all major platforms.
Yeah, and you can email us at earlyinterventionpodcast@gmail.com if there are any topics that come to mind or you would like to be a featured guest. I've also had people email me, tell me something good story. So keep it coming.
Yes.
We want to thank Friends of a Fit Toddler Services for their support with this podcast. FITS develops, maintains, and funds additional services and programs for children served by Infant Toddler Services of Johnson County. They're funded through private donations, fundraising events such as the annual Fall Ball Gala, Tee Off for Tots Tournament, and through various grants. And you can learn more about their work by visiting our website, itsjc.org. And it is time to say goodbye.
Until next time.